Matthew chapter 7 and verse number 1. I'm reading in the New King James Version. Judge not that you be not judged, for with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the same measure you use, it will be measured back to you. Why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me remove this speck out of your eye, and look, a plank is in your own eye? Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck out of your brother's eye. Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you in pieces. Ask and it will be given you, seek and you will find, knock and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, he who seeks finds, to him who knocks it will be opened. Or what man is there among you who, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a serpent? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give good things to those who ask him? Therefore, and here is the golden rule, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them. For this is the law and the prophets. Christians play a lot of indoor games. They always have done. But there is one indoor game that's more popular than other indoor games with Christians, and it's called Let's Label. And here's how the game works. First, you find those who are different from you. Identify those who are different from you. They may sound different, different accent. They may look different, wear different make of clothes. They may even think different. They may act different. But find, first of all, those who are different from you. And then you can start the game, Let's Label, if you find somebody, first of all, who's different. It's played in steps. The first step is find something about them that you don't like. And your second step is examine the externals very carefully. How they look, how they dress, what kind of car they drive, where they worship. Follow them around, if you like, in their daily lives. And examine the external. What bank they go to, whatever. Third step, very important in the Let's Label game, is form critical opinions of them. And the fourth step is, as quick as possible, jump to inaccurate conclusions. And fifth, stick a label on them in your mind. And when you find something different, examine the externals, given critical opinions in your mind or form them, jump to inaccurate conclusions, stick a label on them, then the sixth step, absolutely vital in the Christian's game of Let's Label, share your conclusions with others. And of course, the winner gets to wear a very smug, superior look for the rest of the day. There is, of course, another name for the Let's Label game that Christians play. It's called judging. And it's all wrong. Why? Because you and I are never able to know all the facts. Look at him, said the two old ladies in the railway carriage. Look at him. He's typical of modern parents. He's probably divorced from his wife, and those two kids gurning in the corner of this carriage, look at them. They chittered and talked for some time. until the young parent couldn't stick it any longer. And he went over to the two old ladies in the corner of the carriage and said, "Excuse me, ladies, I can't help but to have overheard what you have said about me. I'm not divorced from my wife. My wife is in the guard's van in a coffin. And we are taking her home to bury her." You cannot know all the facts. And I have to say that I am very good at playing this let's label game, unfortunately. Very skilled at it. And I find it a lovely game to play. It appeals to my flesh like nobody's business, and I play it a lot. Until the Spirit of God really begins to stir me. And then I know that I really have sinned. Of all the sins that I've committed, I certainly would personally confess to this as top of my list, near enough. I don't know where it would be on yours. It's so easy. I do it all the time. Judging people quickly and then finding out the facts and then finding out I was big-mouthed, quick-tempered, jumping to conclusions and all wrong. Why, not only can you not only know all the facts about the person you were judging, you don't know the hidden motives behind what they're doing. You can't tell what's making them do what they're doing. And so many people judge other people on the outward, not realizing the inward motive. And because in every judgment that I make, I have one thing I must always remember. I am never free of prejudice. And the older I grow, the more I am convinced that the greatest enemy of truth is prejudice. Now you think about that. Years after I've told you. As your life rolls by, you'll find what I'm saying is right. That the greatest enemy of truth is prejudice. You're prejudiced against somebody because of how they dress, because of where they go, because of where they work, because of what schooling they have had or haven't had, or whatever, or their background. If you are prejudiced against them, it colors everything they say and everything they do, even when they are telling you the truth. Hidden motives. Not knowing all the facts. And don't you find it, folks, in life, don't you find it that things are hardly ever as they seem? Hardly ever. You find that. You just get underneath the surface and you'll be amazed. Hardly ever as they seem. If there's one thing I can't stand, it's somebody saying, "He's a very ordinary fellow, you know." There is no such a thing as an ordinary fellow or girl or man or woman. You get underneath the surface of their life and you'll find some fascinating things. Years ago, I took the marriage service of a little man, and he's the only little man who ever talked to me while I married him. It was by private license in the Burns Memorial Hotel by the Brigadoon in Ayr, the very heart of Scotland. He was about 70 years of age, and he was marrying for the second time a lady who was marrying for the second time who was just a little younger than she was, and the pair of them were like teenagers. They were so happy. And I can see him yet sitting with his oldest grandchild on his knee, a baby of 6 months at his wedding, and bouncing it up the table on his knee. laughing, and we all laughed with him. And you know, the more I got to know that little man, he was a real good friend of mine and a lovely Christian. I was fascinated to see what he'd been through. One day, I discovered he had been General Montgomery's Morseman on D-Day. Not horseman, Morseman. Beside Montgomery's van, he sat down and he sent the Morse between Montgomery and General Eisenhower on the other side of the channel, right in the middle of D-Day. And I remember saying to him, because he was a German prisoner of war in Germany, he went into the Battle of El Alamein in a glider, and the Nazis came down upon him to kill him, and he'd left his Bible behind in the glider, and he wanted to go back, but he thought maybe the Lord might forgive him for not going back for the Bible. Now, what a character. And I remember him telling me all about his wartime experiences. And during the wedding service, I said, you know, I said to him, Dave, the steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord. He said, thank you very much, Derek, right out in the middle of the service. And it was that intimate. What a wedding day. My wife says it was the best wedding service she was ever at. She enjoyed it so much. On the best day she ever had at a wedding. So if you're about 70 and getting over it, don't forget to invite us to your wedding. But you know, you meet an older person, and young people remember this. They say, older people, you know what? They're not rapping with our generation. Always listen to older people. Take time with older people. Listen to them. Because older people can tell you things about the past and about their experience and save you a lot of heartache if you listen to the lessons they'll teach you. I find it fascinating at times just to take time with an older person. Don't rush, just take time with them, to talk with them. There's an old man in an assembly where I preach in Scotland, and he ran against Eric Little one day, Chariots of Fire man. And you know, he told me how that a guy from London came out onto the cinder track, in a famous cinder track there in Glasgow, in an athletic meeting with a great big white toweled robe on him, sticking his chest out, and he was going to show everybody how he could run. Not all Englishmen are like that, thank the Lord. But this guy was, and this Christian, older man, he said, Derek, he said, I watched him come out, and then Little came out, and you know, Eric Little always ran with his head back. When he really got going, he used to say to the Lord, when I run, he said, I can feel his pleasure. And Eric Little ran for it, and he said, the head went back, and all the fella from London could see was a pair of heels. He left him far behind. I think he lapped them in the end. So the white robe was no use. Eric Little. When Sally Magnuson went to do a BBC documentary on the life of Eric Little, the man who didn't run on Sunday, she couldn't, and who played football on a Sunday afternoon in prison camp to save children from getting into sexual indulgence. Isn't that interesting? As a principal, he didn't run on Sunday, but when the kids in the prison camp had nothing to do and were getting into sin, he organized a football match for them on a Sunday afternoon. See the balance? And in this particular situation, you know, Sally Magnuson, Magnus's daughter, went to make a documentary called The Flying Scotsman on Little, and she talked to the men who'd been in prison with him. And she said there were other Christians she met, and the tough men who were in prison didn't really like the other Christians, but everybody she met and everywhere she went, she couldn't find a single person to say a word against Eric Little. Nobody would say a thing against him. Anywhere, in prison or out. And then I discovered that amazing fact that every single day of his life, Eric Little read the Sermon on the Mount every single day. That'd be a good practice for you and me, to read this sermon every day. Won't take long, but if you imbibe it as a Christian, It'll transform your personal dealings with others, particularly in the area of judging. To judge another is to clearly disobey Christ. And according to verse 1 and 2 of chapter 7, you and I are not to be a judge. Judge not, that you be not judged, for with what judgment you judged, you will be judged, and with the same measure you use, it'll be measured back to you. There aren't any more better known words of Christ than these: judge not, that you be not judged. But there are not any words of Christ anywhere that are more misunderstood than the words, judge not, that you be not judged. For example, Count Tolstoy, War and Peace, Anna Karenina, great novelist, and so on. Tolstoy believed that this verse meant that Christ totally forbade the human institution of any law court. And he wouldn't recognize the law courts of Tsarist Russia. And he virtually became treated as an anarchist. One of the greatest writers in all history. For me, the greatest novelist who ever lived. So far. Christ forbade the human institution of any law court. Now, is that what Christ's saying? You're not allowed to have a judge to judge anybody in a law court. No, Jesus' prohibition in this verse can't possibly mean that in the context, because the context doesn't refer to judges. He's not talking to judges. He is talking to believers in their personal relationships with each other, not judges. The responsibility of individuals to one another within his kingdom. And our Lord's injunction to judge not cannot be understood as a command to suspend your critical faculty. Now think about this. Christ is not saying, now just suspend all your critical faculties in relation to other people. Turn a blind eye to everybody's faults. Pretend not to notice that others have faults. Is that what it means? No. Eschew all criticism of other people and refuse to discern between what's true and what's in error, between goodness and evil. Well, that's what New Agers do. It's interesting that this gentleman that the Duchess of York is allegedly to be involved with, this American, is a New Ager. And she is said, allegedly, to be influenced by his New Age thinking. I have warned of this movement in public before, and now it is tearing at the very heart of our nation. And New Agers are extremely promiscuous. New Agers, by and large, are extremely dangerous in the area of saying that there is no such a thing as truth and error, but they're all just shades of the universal one. I'm not saying that necessarily that's what he believes, but that's what New Agers by and large believe. How can we be sure that Jesus was not referring to these things? Well, partly because it wouldn't be honest to behave like that. It would be hypocritical. And we know from this and other passages that Christ's love of integrity was great and Christ's hatred for hypocrisy was great. And partly because it would contradict the very nature of man, whose creation in God's image includes the ability to be able to make value judgments. Animals don't make value judgments like a human being does. And surely most of Christ's teaching on the Sermon on the Mount is based on the assumption that we should use our critical powers. Didn't Christ teach us to be different from the world around us? Well, how could you be different from the world around you if you couldn't judge what was worldly and what was godly? You'd have to use your critical powers. If Christ said you had to be more righteous than the Pharisees were in their hypocrisy, you'd have to be able to criticize the Pharisees where they were wrong so that you could be more righteous for him on another side by his power, the other side of the culture, you being the counterculture. How could you be part of the counterculture if you couldn't know where the culture around you was wrong? You're not to be like the heathen, says Christ, because of their constant use of phraseology in their prayers. Cut it out, says Christ. Don't pray like that. Well, then you'll have to criticize the heathen when they pray, won't you, with a value judgment. That's wrong and this is right. It would be impossible to obey the commands of the Sermon on the Mount without using your critical powers and your critical judgment. So if Jesus isn't abolishing the law courts and forbidding criticism, what does he mean then when he says, judge not that you be not judged? Well, I love John Stott's word for this and his brilliant exposition of this passage, which I'm leaning heavily on. He says, in a word, you are not to be censorious. You say, what on earth does censorious mean? Well, a follower of Jesus is still a critic in the sense of using his powers of discernment, but he isn't a judge in the sense of being censorious. Censoriousness is a kind of a compound sin. It consists of the unpleasant ingredients that I've already listed in point number one when you play the Let's Label game. It does not mean, when it goes into action, to assess people critically. No, a censorious person goes out to judge them harshly. Now, you think this doesn't talk to me? This is really getting down to the nitty-gritty now, folks, for all of us. When I go out to criticize someone, I'm making a value judgment about what they're saying or what they're doing. Am I being critical in a positive sense, or am I judging them harshly? Censorious critic is a fault finder who is negative and destructive towards other people and enjoys actively seeking out their feelings. In fact, sometimes you will find you sit down in company and if you didn't talk about other people and what they're up to, there wouldn't be any conversation. Just check out your usual conversations in company. Just add this to it, you know, this dimension. Just be assessing it as you talk. Is it all taken up with other people's faults and what they're up to and so on? It's very, very, very difficult sometimes to lift conversations socially above the level of that merely critical thing. And even people enjoying seeking out other people's feelings. A censorious person makes the worst possible construction on other people's motives, pours cold water on their schemes, and is ungenerous towards their mistakes. Are you censorious? Am I? To be censorious is to set myself up as a censor and to claim the competence and authority to sit in judgment upon my fellow men. And that can cast my fellows and myself in the wrong role. Remember, Paul wrote to the Romans. What did he say? He certainly didn't turn a blind eye to their faults, did he? He applied this truth to them. Who are you, he says, to pass judgment on the servant of another? It is before his own master that he stands or falls. If that other Christian is serving the Lord is his master, not me. 1 Corinthians 4, I know nothing by myself, Yet am I not hereby justified, but he that judgeth me is the Lord. Therefore judge nothing before the time, until the Lord come, who will both bring to light the hidden things of darkness, and will make manifest the counsels of the hearts, and then shall every man have praise of God. Paul is making a simple, vital point. He is saying, you and I are not to play God. We are not God. We cannot truly read each other's hearts. We cannot read or assess each other's motives. And if we're getting into this censorship business, it's to presume arrogantly to, says Paul, anticipate the day of judgment and to usurp the prerogative of the divine judge. When we get there, the old hymn is right. Deeds of merit as we thought them, he will tell us were but sin, and little acts we had forgotten, he will tell us were for him. The more I work in Christian work, the more I see that whenever I assess a thing myself of success or even failure, I am constantly wrong. That which I think is failure in the Lord's work, what I have done and I'm depressed by it and in failure, is the very thing often that God uses most. And that which I think was a success hasn't turned out to be as successful as I thought it was. When you are weak as a Christian, then you are strong. Don't judge things, even in your own life. So many people I have to counsel, gladly counsel, but have to face the problem that they are even playing God on their own lives. And it leaves them wrecked with depression and guilt. Stop assessing everything. Do it with a proper motive as unto the Lord and according to his word, and go forward and trust him to assess it perfectly. And of course, the constant problem, mostly in Christian work, is they assess everything by anything done in the Christian world as how many were there. Can you see the Lord Jesus coming down from the temple in the morning and the Lord saying, oh, I had a terrible morning this morning. There were only 5 out. I was speaking down there and there were only 10. No. Some of his greatest work was done with individuals. So stop getting depressed and playing God on others and on yourself. This is very important. So you're not to be a judge in a censorious sense, judging people harshly, not checking out the motivation, etc. Don't be that kind of person. Yes, you're allowed to use your critical powers. Of course you are, but not in that manner. Then verse 3 and 4, which is really quite humorous. The Christian is not to be a hypocrite. Now comes Jesus' famous little parable about the speck of dust on the one hand and the logs or beams on the other. You remember he exposed hypocrisy in your prayer life. Don't be hypocrite in your prayer life, practicing piety before men to be seen by them. Now he's exposing hypocrisy in relation to other people. Not hypocrisy before God now so much as hypocrisy in relation to others. Here's somebody struggling with the delicate operation of removing a speck of dust or a speck of dirt from a friend's eye. And if you've ever had something in your eye, you know how your eye closes immediately. It's a very sensitive, painful business. But the guy who's coming along to pick out the little speck of dirt out of his friend's eye and say, oh, there's a terrible little speck of dirt there. Just a minute, let me get my handkerchief. And he's working away on it while a huge plank is stuck in his own eye, wobbling up and down almost. Can you see it, you know? A huge log right out of his eye. Well, a fellow I heard once said, Jesus never smiled, you know. Well, he didn't read this passage, did he? Can you not see the people smile at the incredulity of this situation? Yet, when the caricature is transferred to ourselves and our ridiculous fault-finding, we don't always appreciate the joke, do we? We have a fatal tendency to exaggerate the faults of others. And minimize the gravity of our own. We have a rosy view of ourselves, and we have a very jaundiced view of others. We're often seeing our own faults in others and judging them very harshly. We experience the pleasure of self-righteousness without the pain of penitence. Self-righteously, we take the specks out of their eyes, trying to minimize the huge plank or log in our own. "You hypocrite," says Christ. That's a powerful expression. "You are a hypocrite," he says. That's a key expression. It's the kind of hypocrisy. It's more unpleasant because of an apparent act of kindness. Such a kind lady to take the speck out of my eye. You know, people are like that. Because of an apparent act of kindness, such a kind man, he's being so kind to me, pointing out my fault. And of course, he's inflating his own ego because he himself is a hypocrite. You know, that's the power of the Sermon on the Mount. It gets away below all the guff and all the cover and all the old plastic thing, if you like, of outward things, and way in to the motivation.